a shot in the dark, wary sort of spark. I'm a light that's too bright for me to see.
Welcome back to The Counterposition. I am your humble host, Andrew Whaley, here on Breadbox Media. All right, kids, here we go. Episode 252. Oh, time marches on. I'm telling you, another early morning episode here. I am the staff of my shop this week. Though I did start training my new hires, and I'm kind of excited about that because they're doing a good job already, and I think I am going to have quite possibly the strongest staff I've ever had, which means that I will be able to get a lot done, which I'm very happy about. I've been on this insomnia kick here lately, and I didn't really have insomnia last night. I just have the hardest time going to bed on time. I am an absolute vampire. Maybe I'm just a kid, but I'm a vampire, man. I'm just like, I want to stay up as late as I possibly can. I mean, just, I just cannot. I'm like, I just one more article, one more episode, you know. Oh, you know, we'll just, you know, I just want to read a little bit, you know. I should look at this. Oh, I need to buy that ticket. And you just like constant, like every time I am literally a little kid. Like when it's like, you know, you try to put a little kid to bed and he's like, can I get a glass of water? I'm hungry. You know, I'm just literally that guy. Well, I was all ready to go to bed and I had it all down. I was ready. Like, okay, really decent time. And then I remember that I had left chicken stock on the stove. So I had to go downstairs and drain this chicken stock and clean up. And I ended up cleaning all the dishes and cleaning the kitchen. And just, this is amazing to me. So drove in early. That's one of the good things about doing these early mornings is that I am still shocked at how many people are on the road in Denver, Colorado at 6 o'clock in the morning. I'm like, who are you people and where are you? I'm going to do a radio show before I open a coffee house. Why are you up? And I get here, it's like 6:15 when I walk in the door this morning, 6:10. And there's like six cars in the garage. And I'm like, who goes to an office job at 6 o'clock in the morning? I'm amazed by that. I mean, I know one guy here that works for a nonprofit that lives kind of far away, and just the way his commuter path works is if he doesn't get here by, you know, 5:30, 6 o'clock, then it will take him an hour and a half to get to work, and he can make it in 25 minutes if he comes in early. So he just adjusted his schedule because he cares about working in this place. I'm like, okay, great. I mean, and I get that. I mean, I've lived near Los Angeles, so I get the get up early, get the commute out of the way kind of a thing. But I'm surprised that we're turning into that. But all right. So, what happened yesterday? There was something I wanted to talk about. Oh, all right. So Ken Kramer, my friend, my supposed friend, tagged me on Facebook in that 22 push-up for 22 days awareness for veteran suicide challenge. Now, I know what you're thinking. Come on, dude, 22 push-ups every day. I mean, you know, just do a little Facebook Live video. I've seen you do Facebook Live videos. You're thinking, I mean, how hard is it to do 22 push-ups in a day, right? Yeah, at a time, you know? See, I'm a big fat guy. And so 22, I mean, I used to be able to knock out 22 push-ups, no problem. But if dear Mr. Kramer, if you put your lovely wife, Laura, on your back and did 22 push-ups, that would be what you just asked me to do, okay? I mean, I'm a fairly strong individual. I can bench press something. I can do a little something. I don't know if I can do 22 push-ups. So I'm going to have to do girl push-ups. Which means Ken Kramer has made me do girl push-ups on the internet, and I am none too happy about it. I may have damned his black heart to Starbucks last night on Facebook. So, you know what this is? You know what now I'm in the position of? Now, you know what I'm in the position of? The open mile. That's just the open mile, just like my fourth segment that I'm always griping about. So now, just like when I was the pudgy kid who had a lot of muscle in the off season from football that was doing the shot put and, you know, doing well, and I got to succeed in something that I was built for, you know. No, you got to go out and do the open mile. So I get to run my fat butt, trudging and sweating and huffing all the way around this track four times in front of girls from another school at 15 years old. And now I'm right back there because I'm going to have to do push-ups on the internet. And I'm probably not going to be able to do 22 push-ups. But you know what? I'm going to suck it up. I'm going to suck it up for veteran suicide awareness because it's a damn shame that guys are going and fighting for our country, regardless of what you think about the wars. I mean, I think we're in some wars that are pretty stupid. I don't think we need to be in some of the places we've been. And I'm for a little less of an interventionist kind of, what they call it, the Monroe Doctrine, kind of where we're shaping everything. You know, I'm not really for that, but that doesn't matter. This dude signed up to just protect and serve his country, got sent all over God and creation, and did all this. And then when he gets home, I mean, he's, you know, waiting 6 months for a doctor's appointment or something. It just, you know, and he can't find a job. You know, the guy's like highly skilled, you know, in some thing that he can't find a way to apply here, you know, and he comes back. You know, it's interesting. I think we need to do better at reintroducing our soldiers. You know, I mean, we show all these internet videos of that big moment when a veteran comes home, dad's been overseas missing his family, and he gets right off the plane and he comes in and he surprises the kid at the assembly and the kid freaks out and runs over and jumps in daddy's arms and everyone cries. And, you know, I mean, we really like to see that. That seems to be the return. And maybe for some people, depending on your role in the military and what your experience was in the military, maybe that is your homecoming. Maybe that is how. Maybe all you're missing is the people you love, and that will fix it. You know. But look at another. I remember seeing that movie. I can't remember the name of the movie, with Bradley Cooper playing that guy that was a sniper that was amazing. It was called Sniper. I mean, anyway, when he comes back and he's been a sniper and just straight up killing people, killing bad guys, you know. And he comes back and he gets a call from his wife and he's in a bar in the U.S. and she's like, wait a minute, you're stateside? He's like, yeah. He's just like, well, what are you doing? He's like, well, I need a couple days, you know. It's interesting. It's like, you know, in traditional cultures and ancient cultures, when they would send men off to battle, before they would like let them come back in to the village or come back into the city, they would come back from battle and they would camp outside the city where they could see home and they could have the comfort of knowing, hey, I'm not over there anymore, I'm here. But they could process it. And there were certain rituals, religious rituals, certain poems that would be sung and things they would do and cleansing and stuff like that. And there was a catharsis. There was a way to get that out, right? They acknowledged that you can't just step from this reality right back into this reality. You know, you can't just go from And they think about what ancient battle was like. Ancient battle wasn't like snipers or, you know, working a job back on the lines so that someone else can go fight. I mean, ancient battle was you carrying a sword or a spear or a knife and literally plunging it into some other dude and then walking around the rest of the day killing other people or trying not to get killed with, like, people's blood and your own blood all over you in pain. I mean, think about that. That's a brutal reality, but that was... In some ways, it was more like normal reality when you had to hunt to exist. In some ways, I mean, that was less than normal. It was more normal, you know. It was less than not normal. I don't know, why am I into the double negatives this morning? Why are you so negative? Need a cup of Costa Rica Finca. I need a sip of Costa Rica Finca Tonio from Commonwealth here. Maybe we can find a way to a program or something to kind of incorporate these guys a little more, transition them a little more slowly. I don't know how they do that. I don't have much experience with the military. I was never in the military. I tried to go into military, actually. I tried to go into the Army at one point when I was a kid, and they didn't take me. That's a long story. So I don't know. I just think that we can maybe do a better job of getting these guys back into society, giving them a transition back into society in a way that they wouldn't end up, you know, in that kind of a dark place. Because for every one of them that kills themselves, 22 a day, evidently, there's how many people are in like a much darker place, but just don't pull the trigger on it. Yeah, well, literally maybe. But. All right, let's go to the break. When we get back, I got something else to talk about. You're listening to The Counter Position. I'm your host, Andrew.
I'm a sacred word to mutter. Ran too fast and turned to butter. I'm a bit too much for me to chew.
If you enjoy listening to Andrew Whaley on The Counter Position, you should become a friend of the show. Go to breadboxmedia.com and click on Friend of the Show to provide your support. Thank you.
Let me skip across the pond. I'm an ocean on and on. I'm a fish with no bowl that I outgrew. Lift my blood. See, only one on track.
Welcome back to The Counter Position. I am your humble host, Andrew Whaley, here on Breadbox Media. All right, so, man, veteran suicide. What a great way to start the morning, huh? Sorry to, you know, well, I guess you're listening to this at night, so. What a great way to bum you out after you've had a hard day at work and you're listening to my show. But no, it's funny you think about the irony of that, right? The irony of suicide in itself, but the irony of the suicide of a warrior, you know, a very dark irony in the sense that we as human beings, or just as beings, especially, and, you know, locomotive beings, animals, you know, things that feeding tubes on legs that move around. You know, but even more so because we're rational and we have a will and we can reflect on all that. The key thing that we desire, the key thing that really governs all of our faculties, all of our functions, that really defines us in some ways as a natural being, is our continued existence. You know, the fight or flight that happens, you know, when you hear something loud and your adrenaline spikes and you turn around, you know, you jump around and you're like, and it turns out, oh, that the thing fell off the shelf. That's something chemically and structurally in you from when a large sound behind you was probably something trying to eat you or someone trying to kill you, because things were just a lot rougher for the last 2.5 million years before we got to this last little moment in our existence, you know? And so, I mean, in beyond the anticipation of, the imagination of, and the reaction to violence, look at sex drive. and the idea around sex, that's another form of the desire of continued existence. You know, you want your genes, you want your presence in the world, you want your pattern in some way to continue on, your blood to continue on. And it's funny, it's like this thing just drives us in so many ways. I've talked about this before, but there's a great documentary out there that was like on the Discovery Channel, National Geographic or something like that. And it just showed all these studies and all these people and all their activities, people in a bar, people dancing in a bar, drinking or talking and flirting, people, and you know, smelling different things in labs and all that stuff. It's really, really governed by trying to get pregnant or trying to get somebody pregnant. But on a conscious level, you ask any of these people in a bar, hey, are you trying to get someone pregnant tonight? No, no, no. Are you trying to get pregnant tonight? No, 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 not at all. But they like film all these people and things like the swing in the radius of a girl's movements, you know, and the way she moves her hips or something when she's dancing, or how much hair flipping she does and head tossing while she's talking, charted directly to whether or not they were ovulating. And guys are intrinsically drawn, even when they're played samples, towards slight modulations in the voice to a higher pitch, which can signal ovulation and stuff. So we have this like script running underneath that is this deep, 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 deep desire for a continued existence, you know? And I'm going off script today. This isn't what I was going to talk about. Yeah, there is a script, actually. Not a script, but I've got bullet points. And I've got stuff on my bullet points that I've been trying to get to for like 5 days, man. So it's interesting that this idea that you can, because of your experience of yourself and your experience of the world and our ability to reflect on the meaning of those things that an animal doesn't have, that classically that is what made us take over the world. That's what made our species more powerful. We don't have... We're not as strong. We're not as fast. We're not as covered with hair and able to withstand different temperatures, though we can certainly do a lot more than we think we can. And it's really good for us, actually. I've been on this cold shower kick here lately and reading up on cold and heat. But we can also, you know, that reason has allowed us to, you know, be tool makers and strategists and stuff in a way that it's hard for something running on pure instinct to do, you know, though there are instances of some pretty complex tool use among animals. But that also can make you kind of rethink those things, right? That can also make you rethink and kind of second guess that instinct towards your continued existence, right? You can kind of hack yourself, so to speak. And so, you know, it's funny. I just recently, in just the last year, about a year, you know, less than a year ago, I had a really close friend go through go through a period of really deep depression, and I caught them hurting themselves a few times and had to take them to the hospital and, you know, ended up, you know, doing some research and figuring out, found some treatments for them and got them some help and have seen them just blossom and change. But I've never really been around someone. I've been around people, you know, the guy that tagged me in this 22 push-ups thing. It's one of the reasons I'm willing to do this and humiliate myself on the internet. There's a fat guy doing girl push-ups if I have to knock them out. Ken Kramer. Ken has written beautifully. If you want to check out his blog, patchworkpapist.com or patchwork. Yeah, it's patchworkpapist.com. He's got a couple of articles on there. He's a Catholic therapist for 10 years, and he went through a period of suicidal. He tried to kill himself, I think, a couple of times, ended up in the hospital when he was a kid, and then has dealt with suicidal ideation since then. And he has written very, very bravely about his experience. And so I've been around people and been very close to people who have been through that. But that was the first time I'd ever been near someone who was currently going through that, someone that I loved. And it made me really rethink it. I mean, I have gotten really depressed at times. I've gotten super, super depressed. And, you know, I tend to run around about half the time in kind of a low grade, kind of numb depression, kind of, you know, just not kind of optimal where I want to be, but not in that deep, really dark place, you know. And I can, you know, something you can fix with, you know, eating right, living better, do say your prayers, eat your veggies, do some, get a swim in, you know, usually can, you know, more is just like me worrying about stuff all the time and not exercising or eating right. You know, I'm just not running on all cylinders because I'm not functioning as designed, right? But there's been a few times in my life where I've just gotten down. I remember 2006. I lost the girl and the job in 36 hours. And I had been after I had had some stuff happen in my life earlier that made me, I kind of chose numbness. I kind of went numb. Like I really had a lot and I had it going and it all kind of fell apart. And I just shut myself off for a while there. And I didn't cry for a long time. And I used to be a real crybaby, especially like in worship or in prayer or something. I was a real crybaby and I didn't cry for a really long time. And, I didn't really laugh as hard as I used to either. I didn't really belly laugh. I didn't really like just lose myself and just can't get my breath kind of laughter at all. I just kind of numbed down and I was in this relationship for a while and it was a pretty unhealthy relationship. It wasn't, you know, I mean, we were, but it that's a long story, but there was something about, you know, intimacy and affirmation and caring and being able to give yourself and sacrifice for someone else and stuff like that to kind of open me up a little bit, right? And I didn't realize it was opening me up as much. And then when I lost those things, I had a level of feeling that I hadn't had in a while. And I spiraled hard. I mean, really hard. I could not control my emotions. I was going for job interviews and, you know, breaking down crying in the car and stuff. I mean, it was rough. I never talked about this on the air, I don't think. But, I mean, I was a mess. And I remember going to this class at the Augustine Institute down in 2006 and, like, walking out of class acting like I was coughing, going out and sitting on one of those benches in the courtyard at the seminary, throwing my hood up and crying and keeping my hood up and my head down so people would think I was just praying or something and leave me alone when I was like uncontrollably crying underneath my hood. I lost control of my emotions for a couple months. I mean, it was brutal. And I remember just trying to get something going and not being able to get it going and just trying to come up with an idea to start a business or to try to find a job. And I was there, it was right at the end of the school year in a college town. So everyone was downsizing and I just couldn't find something to do. I remember getting to a point where I was like, I'm done. I want to quit. Now, I didn't know what that meant, and I wasn't going to kill myself, but I knew this couldn't keep going this way. I'm done. I'm ready to quit. And I didn't know what quit meant, but I was ready to quit. And I didn't really get to that point, but, that's the only time that I've ever naturally been that close to it. So let's go to the break. When we get back, I got one more story I want to tell about this. I'm just going way off the rails today. You're listening to The Counter Position. I am your host, Andrew Whaley. We'll be right back.
Then how we crave a hanging in his dark.
You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app, change the world.
People singing, please don't stay, but please don't go.
Welcome back to The Counter Position. I am your humble host, Andrew Whaley, here on Breadbox Media. All right, so to my great surprise, my passing acknowledgement of Ken Kramer tagging me in this 22 push-up Facebook veteran suicide challenge has got me riffing on the concept of suicide and depression and all the things around that. So I've talked about how recently I walked through this situation with suicide, not suicide straight up attempts, but some self-harm and a deep desire for suicide with a close friend of mine, which I've never been through before. And I've had to like take him to the emergency room and kind of check him in. I had to like, you know, kind of research options and help. And it, so if I say it worked out beautifully, the guy's night and day now. I mean, we found the right treatments and just some miraculous stuff. In fact, at some point, he's kind of open about it at this point and wanting to talk about it, especially with the solution that he found. And so I may get him on the show at some point. We may just interview and talk about it. I don't know if he wants to be that public with it, but anyway, close friend of mine just completely went through this. And I just talked a little bit about how I went through a very deep depression, after having the bottom fall out, losing the girl and the job in 36 hours back in 2006. I mean, just right in quick succession. I lost the girl first, just in case. I was employed when she left, just for the record. Well, fairly well, but so it would have stung a little worse if it had been like I lost a job, then I lost a girl. Would have been like, well, hey, she was just here for the money or something, you know, because it wasn't that much money. But I would have, but it happened the other direction. So she quit me when I was employed. There's a long story there, though. There's that I'm not going to get into, but that was she broke up with me because for my own good, she thought that it was for my own good. But the only other time that I've ever been through this suicide type thing. Now, I will take that back. I said that was the only time I'd ever thought about it. I did get really close at one point, but it was chemically induced. I had a back injury and I was going through chiropractic and stuff. And I've been laying on the floor for just damn near about 6 months in pain. Like mind-numbing pain. Now, I'm sure that plays a role with some of these guys that are veterans. I mean, they're coming back with injuries and trying to get treatment for some kind of an injury, and maybe they lost a limb or something. There's ghost pain and stuff like that. I mean, it's like that's brutal. So pain, I'm sure, plays a role in it. It'd be interesting to see what numbers were in chronic pain. But I had been just in chronic mind-numbing nerve pain, and you know, I'll cut to the end of the story. Turns out my bulging disc was not bulging, it was collapsed on the inside, and it was in fact sitting on my sciatic nerve, and they didn't see that in the MRIs. So I sat around for 6 months begging for more pain medication, and with a disc sitting in my nerve, and I was in mind-numbing pain for 6 months. It was brutal. It's the hardest thing I've ever gone through in my entire life. I can't imagine ever going through that again. I mean, though I live with a decent level of pain sometimes, praise God here lately, I haven't had it as much. But when I first moved to Denver, something went wrong with my upper back. And I was just like, I would get up from a chair to go make a coffee for someone, and I would have to stop and catch my breath because my entire upper back would just like clench and spasm from something going on. So, I mean, I've been through stuff since then, but nothing remotely like that, man. Nothing like that sciatic thing. I ended up having to have a microlumbar discectomy, and they pulled a disc out of my back because it was literally just sitting on the nerve. During that process, they, as a last ditch effort to keep me from having to have this surgery, they gave me steroids. And they told my mom, they said, now watch him. This might make him a little down. And she knew I was already just like hurting hard. And so I took these steroids, and I think it was on the second dose, you know, like later that day, I took my second dose of these steroids. And I can remember sitting in my mom's basement in the house she had over on Themis and in Cape Girardeau, Missouri. I remember sitting in that basement very calmly. I mean, I wasn't worked up. I wasn't crying. And I was very calmly trying to figure out which of the two overlooks that look over the Mississippi and the train tracks out there at Trail of Tears State Park. I was just very calmly and very rationally trying to remember which one of them was higher, because I had somewhere along the line just made the decision I was going to jump off one of them. And I was just like kind of getting, looking for my shoes and kind of getting my stuff together and just going to, you know, in pain and just like, you know, just going to go. I was just going to go do it. I mean, I wasn't sad. I wasn't worked up. It was just like, oh, well, this is what I need to do. I mean, I was just, and then some God moved, or the steroids wore off, or both, or whatever. And I came to my senses and I was like, what am I doing? And I went and I poured those steroids down the toilet and got up the next morning, called the doctor, told him what happened, said, I want the surgery. And we ended up having a surgery. So I don't really count that one, because I was really, really down and really frustrated in pain and starting to kind of get disillusioned to the point of like, I don't know how. I mean, I did get to the point when I was in pain for 6 months like that, that I did get to the point where I was like, okay, if I knew this was going to be my life, I would really be tempted to end it. Now, I don't think that's an answer. I don't think that's a good idea. I don't think that there are people who learn to live with chronic pain and still have very meaningful, full lives. But at that point in the game, if I'd have thought, man, there's no hope on this level, and I'm going to be like this forever, I might have knocked it out. I don't know. I certainly would have gave it a thought. And so, I don't know. It's, but that wasn't what was going on. I went from that not really occurring to me to like planning it, and they had warned us about it when they gave me the steroids. So that, I don't count that one. That was chemically induced. But yeah, in 2006, I mean, I don't know. I didn't get to the point where I'm like, I was thinking about killing myself or something, but I certainly did get to the point where I was like, going forward like this and feeling like this is not even remotely an option, you know? And so I ended up just selling all my furniture and selling everything I could and getting enough gas money and moving back to California. And went back to selling wine and actually discerned with a religious order. But that's a whole nother long story. But I just had to have something that big of a break. I had to like change my way of life and my location and my employment and everything to kind of cut that cycle, because I was spiraling really hard. So if you don't have that option, you know what happens? You know, you have to find some way to re-engage reality or something. You have to find some way to see the good of your existence in a way that you didn't see it before. The thing that defined the goodness of your existence has to evolve in some way. You can't keep using the same thing you were using before as the reason for why it's good that you are, you know? And that can be the hardest thing in the world. Now, I want to switch gears a little bit. This kind of leads me into something else. So I was talking to a friend over the weekend, and I had found out that this friend had been through, I didn't realize this friend was like drinking as hard as they were and smoking a lot of weed and had really, I knew that they smoked and I knew that they had a drink now and again, but I knew they were really disorganized and dropped a lot of balls and everything. But it turns out that they're, and this person and I are not really close by any means. I would consider them a friend, but, we're not like intimate friends by any means. And hopefully if one of my intimate friends was going through this, I would definitely know about it. This is more of an acquaintance that I have to deal with on a regular basis. And they're like, yeah, I quit. You know, I quit drinking. I quit smoking. I'm in AA. And then we were talking, having the conversation about the Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, that conversation, the 12-step conversation. And we talked a little bit about that, about, you know, kind of that there's a classic concept in kind of 12 step where you kind of hit rock bottom, you know? I heard this old guy one time quoted talking about, you know, or a guy was talking about AA, and he was talking about this, well, something this old man said to him. He kept going, I don't think you're ready. You should go get some more pain. He's like, yeah, you ain't hurt enough, evidently. He's like, go, I'll keep going. Go get you some more pain. So you'll get ready at some point, you know. And there's kind of this idea where, but when you get to that point where you can't keep going like that, you know, maybe it's with addiction, maybe it's with alcohol addiction, or with drug addiction of some kind, or some kind of behavior that's completely unhealthy in that way, and you're like, I cannot go on like this. Some people confuse I can't go on like this with I can't go on, and those aren't the same thing. And I think that maybe helping people make that distinction might be a big part of the process with this whole suicide thing. But you know, when we get back from the break, I want to talk about, I had an insight about AA and 12 step and stuff that I want to play out a little bit and riff on a little bit. That's a heavy show today. I'm sorry. Not nearly enough chatty. Maybe I'll give you a recipe or something at the end. Yeah. All right. I do have a food thing to talk about. All right. So you're listening to The Counter Position. I am your host, Andrew Whaley.
Then all the colored glass, that painter's palette smash, all the colors of my soul.
If you enjoy listening to Andrew Whaley on The Counter Position, you should become a friend of the show. Go to breadboxmedia.com and click on Friend of the Show to provide your support. Thank you.
I'm a hyena laughing fool. I'm a hero without anyone to save. Love decked myself in toys. I'm a poor and kingly boy. Oh, I'm lovely, and I'm dull.
Welcome back to The Counter Position. I am your humble host, Andrew Whaley, here on Redbox Media. All right, so the fourth segment, the fat boys run the open mile, making that last lap. The fat radio host is doing girly push-ups on the internet for veteran suicide because Ken Kramer tagged him. Oh, damn your black heart to Starbucks, Ken Kramer. I would never damn anyone's heart to Starbucks, for real. That's a horrible place to damn someone's heart to. And I love Ken Kramer more than I love most people in this world. I adore that man. I can't wait to go see him and his lovely wife Laura up in Montana at the Fort Belknap Indian Reservation. Hey, speaking of people who were completely out of control in some ways and then got it together and then have found a new way to live, I got Anthony Bourdain's cookbook in the mail yesterday. So Anthony Bourdain, author, the author of Kitchen Confidential, per a fairly famous book, the host of No Reservations, and then on the Travel Channel, I think it was, and then later Parts Unknown, which I think is like on CNN or something like that, you know. He released his first cookbook, and it's just kind of like, all right, if you want to say you can cook, and you know food and you cook food, these are things that you need to know. And it's kind of like, yeah, Ralph Steadman did the cover of it. Oh man, that's a throwback to the day. So and just the way that he's got some great shots of Eric Repair in there, owner of Avec, and some cool, really cool, crazy images of his wife and daughter and stuff. So it's real punk rock. You know, he's kind of got that rock and roll punk rock attitude. Anthony Bourdain doesn't. There's some killer recipes in this thing, man. That cookbook's worth buying. You know, I'm a big fan of just knowing how food works and not just replicating recipes. And Bourdain's a guy that obviously just knows how food works, and he'll tell you how it works, and he'll tell you, you know, here's a recipe and here's how I'll do it. And he's vague enough and general enough to force you to think about it on kind of that universe, that more kind of principle level. It's pretty good. I'm a fan. It's a pretty rock and roll punk rock cookbook. It's good stuff. Yeah. I think it's called Appetites. Anyway, worth buying. But Bourdain was like, you know, doing drugs and just an absolute mess for years and kind of slowly crawled up and out of it. He seemed like he replaced doing drugs with drinking too much and putting himself in incredibly dangerous situations all over the world, and then slowly found some meaning in that travel and that eating and all that, and then ended up getting married and having a kid, and that seems to have transformed his life in a lot of ways, you know. But I want to get back to this concept of Alcoholics Anonymous that we were talking about. So I was talking to a friend of mine. Who was I talking to about this? Oh, Ducky, Jim Laurent, and Perry West. We ended up having like a little random summit in my room the other night, and that turned into praying night prayer. It was nice. I got a good crew in my house right now, a really good crew. But we were talking. I was telling them about this conversation I had with a friend about them kind of stopping drinking in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I had this insight that addiction is about numbness. Addiction is about living in a way that you can numb yourself down, and it might be giving yourself a heightened experience. You know, it might be the kind of drug you do gives yourself a heightened experience, or you might be doing porn, or you might be addicted to gambling or some kind of other dangerous behavior. Maybe you jump out of airplanes or something. Or you might be into downers or whatever, just drinking really hard to keep yourself at a numb level, you know. But the idea is about addiction, and it's all drug addiction, jumping out of airplanes, porn, gambling, these dangerous behaviors, even obsession with certain just like normal behaviors or whatever, that releases dopamine. So you're addicted to dopamine. You're not addicted to gambling. You're not addicted to porn. You're addicted to dopamine and norepinephrine and, you know, these different chemicals that are released. That's just a quick way to get them. That doesn't require cocaine. You know, if you're doing cocaine, you're addicted to dopamine and all the chemicals that your body produces when you shove cocaine into it. It's not actually the cocaine you're addicted to. It's just a really quick way that's cheaper than faster than jumping out of an airplane. But all these things are the idea behind addiction is that I'm going to put a chemical barrier between me and reality because I can't handle reality. I can't be in front of reality, and I need to, you know, it's like a picture, like, you know, boxing, right? You know, if you're going to get in the ring with a boxer that's like really strong or something, you know, you're sparring, you got to put some headgear on and a bodyguard and make them wear really big soft gloves, and you have to numb it down. You can't handle the brute reality, that you can't handle a brute engagement with that reality. And sometimes reality feels kind of like getting into a bare knuckle boxing match with something you're completely someone you're completely unmatched to handle. You know, and so you have to numb that. You can't feel that anymore. So you use chemicals, right? Well, the insight that I had was that's kind of what communion and liberation is about. That's what Jazani's talking about. That's what the whole idea of living the real intensely, which is a big phrase that Monsignor Luigi Jazani. So communion liberation is a movement in the Roman Catholic Church, which is different than kind of the other movements. And it's interesting. I was just hearing a story the other day about how a certain scholar had gone to Hans-Urs von Balthasar, and he said, hey, who's living your vision? Like, is there anyone on earth kind of like living this thing that you've been writing about all this time? You know, your vision for this stuff. And he said, yeah, there's this guy named Monsignor Luigi Gisani, and he has this movement, Communion Liberation. You should meet him, you know? But living the real intensely, CL is about, at its core, about getting this filter of ideology out from between you and reality, about not living through a filter of ideology, even if it's a true ideology. But that's just not the role of truth. That's not our relationship that we're designed to have with truth, is to kind of have it separating us from reality. Truth is supposed to be the experience of reality putting an impression on us. You know, Aristotle talks about that tabula rasa, that blank slate, you know, and through the senses and through our person, through the full engagement of the human person. You know, Gisani uses the word reason, but for him, reason is not just kind of our intellective faculty directed towards its proper object, which is kind of the real through, and we know it intellectually. For him, reason and reasonableness is the full engagement of the big picture of the human person, and the full deep ergonomic nature between the human person and the real. And that engages your imagination, your will, your everything about you, right? We're built for reality, and we're built to engage reality directly. And so CL is trying to get, so sometimes we get, you know, we put something, food, sex, drugs, alcohol, gambling, something, we put something between us and reality to numb that, or to filter that in some way. Sometimes we get past that. We get past like this just strictly dangerous behavior or sinful behavior or whatever, and we replace that with kind of a moralism or an ideological kind of filter, an ideological moralism that is constantly between us and reality, and we're viewing everything through kind of this dogmatic filter, as opposed to letting reality engage us and then comparing our experience and judging our experience in light of reality and in light of our experience, and reading other things and comparing them to our experience of reality, and then maybe letting it shape us, or giving us a new insight or a new language, a new word to describe it or something like that. But instead we let it just govern our experience of the world. And that's, in a way, that's kind of an addiction. So, it's funny, my friend Jonathan Gailey, one time when I were talking about CL, and he says, see, I need AA. I need Abstraction Anonymous. You know, this is what Michael Wallstein was talking about. I've talked about this when he was talking about Aristotle's version of the cave, and about these guys that live in these well-lit rooms under the ground, and they have everything to be happy, but it's all artifacts. Concepts are artifacts. Concepts are not the real. Concepts are something we abstract from the real. We're not designed to live on concepts, and we're not designed to live on drugs. We're designed to live on reality. So, yeah, man, I'm all fired up and deep this morning. All right, that's it. That's all I got for you. Forgot to do this yesterday, but Jennifer fixed it. So let's pull the plug, pop the cork on another episode of The Counterposition. See you on the other side.
I take your place, marble stone. I take your place, marble stone.